Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you all so much for coming. Thank you also to the Tattered Cover for having me and creating this wonderful event. Thanks, Lisa. Can I take this off and walk around with it?
Okay. Otherwise, I feel like I'm in one of those presidential debates or something.
So I'm Chris, and I am going to thank a few more people before I get started. I'd like to thank my wonderful wife, Allison, who is here. She's a pirate. Where is she? There she is. And also some very special friends who are here tonight, most of them also in costume. I couldn't have done this without them. They've been incredibly supportive every step of the way. So thank you all very much. It means a lot to me. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the journey, how I got to be here. I'll talk a little bit about the book, and I'll do a reading or two from the book, answer any questions that you have, and then I have some prizes to give away. And then stick around, because at the end, there'll be music playing, DJ Shibango, the Tripnotist is also in the house, and I'll be signing books, which are available for purchase. So, full evening planned. Or at least until the Tattered Cover closes at 9 o'clock. So, the strangest thing to me since I began telling people that I have a book coming out, or now that it's out, telling people that I have a book that's out and you can buy it, is that a lot of people, I'm just going to get closer, I think, coming out. A lot of people say to me, whoa, I've always wanted to do that. I've always wanted to write a book. And I, you know, sit next to somebody on the plane and they say, what do you do? I'm like, oh, my first book just came out. And they say, well, I've always wanted to write a book. And sometimes these people are quite old, you know, and they're like, oh, I've always wanted to do that my whole life. And the first thing I think is, well, why haven't you? But the second thing I think is, well, that's weird, because I never really thought about writing a book myself. It wasn't that I didn't want to write one, but it wasn't something that I was constantly thinking about. I just love stories. I always have. I'm going to give you some examples. When I was little, my dad would read me books all the time. He reads a lot of things like Charles Dickens and stuff, which aren't always the most fun when you're, you know, about five. But he also read me things like The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, and he did all the voices. And it would transport me to this other place. And I grew up in England, where it's easy to sort of imagine that you are a hobbit because you drink a lot of tea, and there's you have 11 Z's, and it's very green, and so you sort of feel like, yeah, I could be in this story. Then as I got a little bit older, I saw Star Wars for the first time, which was a big, profound moment in my life. And I thought, well, maybe I could be maybe I'm not a hobbit, maybe I could be a Jedi Knight. And I would, in fact, come home from school and sit in the back garden and try to move my mum's flower pots around using the Force. So I did this for a while until my mum finally came out from the kitchen and said, Chris, there is magic in this world, but you will never be able to move those flower pots using the Force. Which was okay, because by this point I had discovered Indiana Jones, another profound influence on my life, and I thought, it's cool, I'll be an archaeologist. My dad seized upon this, because I think he always was a little worried that my head was up in the clouds, and he took me to an archaeological dig. He said, this is great, this is a big step up from Jedi Knight. And I went to an archaeological dig where there was no giant boulders or bullwhips or Nazis or gunfights or car chases. I scraped at the remains of an old Roman wall with a toothbrush all day and thought, yeah, I'm not going to be an archaeologist. So then when I was about 14, I read On the Road by Jack Kerouac, and then I read everything else that the man had written, and I started to read all the other beat writers, and I thought, okay, forget, you know, orcs and Jedis and Indiana Jones. This is something I can do. Go to the States, hitchhike around, find myself, you know, music and women and drink and you know, Buddhist philosophy, all that kind of stuff. I was like, this is something I can do. And I went off to try to do that. I traveled around the world for a while. I traveled a lot around the States. I started to read, I transitioned from there to people like John Muir and Aldo Leopold, Thoreau, Walden. And I was in love with these nature writers, and I thought, maybe I'll go to college and study ecology and environmental sciences and natural resources. So then I did that. And what I've come to realize is that these stories, which I once thought were sort of an escapism, a distraction, something to get lost inside, were really much more than that. They were things that gave me tools for living. They changed my life. They transformed me. They inspired me. And they made me who I am today. When I read a story that I love, it is reminding me of who I want to be and what I want to do in the world, and reminds me that I want to be the hero of my own life. So ultimately what the stories inspired me to do was start writing stories. This Rootless, where's my, isn't there like a giant thing of it somewhere? Oh, it's over there. Okay. Well, anyway, you've probably all seen the cover, but here it is. It's not my first story. It's not the first one that I wrote down, but it is the first one that people really liked, who weren't my friends and my wife. And it's the first one that got published. So, who has read Rootless? Okay, well, for those of you who haven't, I will give you my best, shortest, coolest description of it. Rootless is set in a devastated, distant future world where nothing can grow except a type of genetically engineered corn. And the main character, Banyan, he's 17 years old, and he builds trees out of metal and scrap, creating these beautiful scrap metal forests for people who still crave some semblance of nature. But at the beginning of the book, Banyan discovers a clue to the whereabouts of the last living trees, and he sets off to try to find them, believing that if he finds the trees, he'll also find his father, who's been missing. Now, along the way, Banyan meets various people who he doesn't know if he can trust them. He is a loner at the beginning of the book, and it's very much about a boy or a young man searching for something important that's been lost, but also trying to make himself whole. And along the way, there are punk rock pirates, Rastafarian warriors, mutated cornfields, and flesh-eating locusts. So it's an action-packed book that is also involves themes, which I won't get into here, because if I do, then all of a sudden it'll be 9 o'clock and they'll be closing the place down. But it's a there's a lot going on in there. It's a fast-paced, action-packed read, but it is not just, there's a little more to it than that. So, to me, ultimately what you do as a writer is you sort of do what Banyan does. He takes these old bits of junk and salvage and creates these beautiful scrap metal forests. And as a writer, you take these scraps of experiences and feelings and you transform them into a story. So you take one thing and you make that one thing something else. I'm going to do a couple of readings from the book. I'm not going to talk more about it and unless you have questions after I do a couple of readings. But I wanted to introduce you to some of the characters from the book. One, Banyan, because he narrates the story. It's written in the first person. And then also a couple of other colorful characters who we sort of have represented here tonight via their costumes. Just take a quick sip of tea. The Hobbit in me. I won't show you my hairy feet. So, Banyan, the tree builder, you're going to meet him. And there's the cover of the book that I was looking around for earlier, the giant cover. So you can look at that if you don't, if you get bored of looking at me. Feel free. Now, so tonight we have we have a very special friend of mine who I'm going to talk more about in a little bit, who created something so that you can experience what I'm about to read you, which is a part of the book where Banyan meets a strange character called the Tripnotist. Now, the trip noticed. Notice he's a strange character because I sort of changed my voice when I say his name. He's this mysterious gypsy chap, and Banyan runs into him when Banyan's discovered the clue to the whereabouts of the last living trees and has set off to try to find them, but he's been captured by someone else who's also searching for the trees, and he's been squeezed inside this metal box with this strange gypsy called the Tripnotist. And this is what happens. The goggles sealed tight and pinched my skin, blocking out any drop of the blue light. My face felt sticky and I tried to keep the panic within me, but I was blind now, blind as well as trapped. "Keep your eyes closed," the Tripnotist said, "lest you want to lose your eyeballs." I squeezed my eyes shut and held my breath as 1,000 tiny spikes pricked my eyelids. I yelled out in horror, but the needles stopped right where they were, not coming any closer, just locking me in place. "Don't move," the gypsy said, his thin voice softer now, almost soothing. And then music started. Strange pulsing music, gurgled beats and squelching bleeps and belches. The sound of bells rose up from the medley, and I felt like I'd been stuck inside a wind chime, ringing and spinning and all blown to pieces. "Welcome to the vibration of sound," a voice said. It was the gypsy's voice, but it had changed, each word booming now, bathed in echo. "Relax and let it ferry you away." It's fun having the mic. Every part of me screamed to stay present, but I felt myself unraveling, the music opening me, untying me. I tried to focus my thoughts on frost, on escape, on getting myself out of this weird coffin and setting myself free. Free. That was how I felt as I slipped into nothingness. Better than sleep, better than dreaming. I tried to fight the feeling for a moment, but then I gave up. I mean, who doesn't want to be free? I saw trees everywhere. Great labyrinths of shiny metal. Every forest me and Pop had ever built. All our trees grown tall and unruly and not a rusty spot between them. At the center of the trees, my father was 100 feet high, perched atop a strip of scaffold, and I was on his back, buried in a blanket, the fabric tied to his shoulders and wrapped around his waist. My father was building. He was hammering out finishing touches, bending at metal so the sun caught right. I felt his arms swinging the hammer, watched sweat beading on the back of his neck. When he welded steel joints, I saw hot sparks fly, and as he descended the ladders, I bounced and jostled and giggled. On the ground, my father stared up at the canopy, and I stared at it with him, listening as the wind blew tunes through the branches, watching as the breeze shook rhythm from the leaves. I heard the gypsy's music again, and then I was older, curled up in the back of the wagon, eating popcorn and listening to my father read. He told me stories of faraway places that had once existed. Tales told by countless fathers before him. Stories of bears and wolves and salmon and streams. The smell of wood on a fire. The sound of birds singing and the brush of their wings. My father spoke me to sleep and I dreamt of waking to a real forest. Our trees grown shaggy and breathing. Bark and moss and twigs and spiders. And in the dream I tried to wake my father so he could see the trees. But the sky grew fierce with the sound of locusts, and when silence returned, every tree was thin and crippled, black and cold. And as the wind blew, the trees began falling upon us, each one of them tumbling and snapping, until I began catching the trees and planting them in ashes. The music rose again, and with it, the trees I had planted all faded, and me and Pop were sat in the dust out past the cornfields. We had our backs to the corn, and we watched Vega glittering in the distance, like a light someone forgot to switch off. It's the end of that passage. It's hot. It's really hot up here. Well, it needs a little dust, and it would be perfect. So that's the Tripnotist, or that's what Banyan experiences in the Tripnotist's memory box. And at the end, while I'm signing books, which are available for purchase, I invite you to visit with the Tripnotist that we have here tonight and put the goggles on and see what happens. Now, I'm going to do another reading, because this is the official Denver book launch. I'm going to do two. Not just one. And we also, as well as the trip notist, we have some pirates here tonight. Right? But these aren't pirates that you might have met before. And they're not the Johnny Depp eye patches pirates. This passage occurs when Banyan's a little further along on his journey to try to find the last living trees. He's escaped the Tripnotist at this point. And it's chapter 19. I had the nail gun tucked at my waist and my shirt pulled down over it, and I kept faking at the engine as the pirates rumbled closer. They had music blasting, a regular party rolling up. The electric sounds of guitars split the air as the first truck sank to a stop. The wind went soft and the dust eased a little. I turned from my engine and made a big deal of staring up at the truck closest to me, flashing the dumbest grin you ever seen. I yelled out about as loud and cheery as I could manage, "Act like you got nothing to worry about." That was my plan. Each one of those tankers had 9 sets of wheels and a solid box on the back, guns spiky off the top and pointy out the side. I studied the lifted tires with rubber-knuckled tread, the graffiti and tinted windows. The music stopped and the engine sighed, then fell silent. I waded over to the truck closest, waving my hands in the air, and just as I reached the cab, its door came flying open, and all I could see was legs. Thighs. Holy shit. As strong as they were pretty. The girl leapt out of the cab and stared down her broken nose at me. Seen one pirate, you seen 100. The mohawks and the rubber boots. 3-foot hair and 6-inch heels. If she was older than me, there weren't much in it. But her eyes showed the true mileage, if you know what I mean. A rifle of some sort hung loose off her shoulder. Goggles dangled around her neck like the dust didn't bother her a bit. "Something wrong with your wagon?" the girl said, crossing her arms as she looked me over. "The power converter," I shrugged. "I think the fuse is fried." "Where are you heading?" "Vega." "Alone? Why, you want to come?" I pushed my goggles up and squinted in the dust as if I might match her in some way. "I could use a little company." The pirate threw her head back in the storm and laughed. Then she stepped closer to me and lifted my shirt up. "So what's this for?" "It's a nail gun." "You always carry it shoved in your pants like that?" "Not always. Just a regular joker, huh? Just stuck on the side of the road, sister. Any chance you got parts for a trade?" "Why? What she got in the back?" she said. One of the trucks began blasting its horns at us. Voices yelled through the dust, but the girl just raised her hand to silence them. She threw open the back of the wagon, peering in at my bag of tools, the scattered bags of popcorn. I was pretty sure I'd left enough in there to make it look realistic. Bit of food, bucket of fuel. "Grab that," she said, pointing at the juice. "What for? You bring it with you. Your tools, too." I reached for the nail gun, panic coming over me, and I tried to pull the gun up, pointed at her, but the pirate just crushed her knee in my chest and I felt my arms go floppy. She grabbed the gun off the ground and shoved it at my arm, lodged a nail there so fast I'd no time to scream. I staggered back, fell. The pain surged through me like my arm had caught fire. My body writhed in the dust. The pirate girl snatched me up with one hand, grabbed my bag of tools with the other, and then she dragged me across the road to the back of her truck. My heels scraped through the dirt, my arm ready to explode. I just stared back at my wagon, and for some reason the worst of it was that hatch left hanging wide open, the car filling up with sand, like the wagon had rolled its last mile and the world was telling me that nothing lasts forever. Nothing, Banyan. Least of all you. Those are the pirates. Well, the beginning of the pirates. So I would love now to answer any questions that anybody has about myself, my writing, or the book. You can just raise your hand and I will pick on you. Don't be shy. Yes. Hey. Yes, well, my dad... Oh, yes. The question was, the book is dedicated to my father, and the question was why did I dedicate it to him? How is he connected to the story and my story? So my dad is a writer. He's a poet. He taught English until he retired at high school, and always encouraged me to read. He never really encouraged me to follow my passions, but he always encouraged me to read. And so I was always for a little while, my dad and I didn't get along so well, and when I started to write, it was a way that we kind of bridged the gap, and we realized the ways that we were similar, not just the ways that we were different. And the book is not just about a young man searching for the lost trees, but it's also about someone, a young man who's searching for his father, physically trying to find him again. And so the book being about that, and that being something which I've experienced, it just made sense to me that I always knew that I would dedicate it to my dad. He was very touched. My mom was not happy. But I told her, hopefully there'll be more books. So, next question. Yeah. Yeah, the question was, my studies in ecology and things, how did that inspire me and inform the book? The book is at its heart about something very special that's been lost and someone trying to bring that back to the world. In this case, it's trees representing all nature, and the world has been devastated because of, it's suggested in the book, that the ways that people have perhaps overly manipulated it. The subject of genetically modified organisms is touched upon, things like that. So a lot of my own personal beliefs or feelings and my background in ecology infused the book. To answer the question, I guess really everything that I love or that I've been interested in almost is in the book. Lots of from music and stories that I've loved, things I've experienced, relationships I've had, and then, you know, my passion for the natural world and the wilderness and wild things. I didn't consciously think about it, but it kind of, afterwards when you look back at it, you go, oh yeah, like, of course, it makes sense. So, yeah, I am passionate about the environment, and I do love to explore places where nothing but wild things grow. So, next question. Yeah. Yeah, I would, the question was, inspiration that I got from people like Jack Kerouac that I was reading when I was about 14, a teenager, what would I say to teenagers? I would say that there is so much more that you can do than a lot of people will give you the credit, or a lot of people try to cap your imagination, and they'll say, you should do this, and then this, and then do this, and the this is always... perhaps it's fine, but if it seems a little constraining to you as far as, you know, career choices or school choices, know that there are plenty of other things that you can do. So, for example, I went to college and then I quit, and then I went and off to try to be Jack Kerouac, and 3 years later I went back to college because I'd found something that I was interested in. But I think it's important to believe that there is magic out there. You just have to find the people that you can create it with. Anybody? Yeah. Paul. Question was, what other countries is the book going to be in? Right now, Scholastic published it in North America and Canada, and we've sold the rights for Spain, Portugal, Brazil, Germany. We just sold the Hungarian rights, so it's sort of like dominoes, you know, people, hopefully anyway, they keep, you know, snapping it up, so... yeah, it hasn't actually been, the publisher hasn't snapped it up in my home country of the UK yet, though, so hopefully that'll happen shortly. Apparently they're a little more slower moving than other countries, which doesn't really surprise me. Yeah. That's right. Yep. It is available. Yes, absolutely. That's true. Next question? Anyone else? Yeah. Yes. Yeah, Hina is a character in the book. I won't give away too much in case you haven't read it yet. But Hina is, first of all, she has a tattoo, and the tattoo offers clues to the whereabouts of the last living trees, or so Banyan thinks. And that tattoo was inspired by a really good friend of mine who has a tattoo kind of just like that on her torso, which is where Hina has hers. So that was something which I kind of pictured the tattoo before I pictured the person, I guess. And then the person, I won't give too much away, but her name was inspired by, it's a legend from a Polynesian legend. And at the time I was reading, I love Joseph Campbell, and I was reading some of his writings at the time that I was writing the book, and Hina had been in the story for a while, but she didn't have a name yet because Banyan hadn't learned her name yet. And when I got to the chapter where he was going to learn what her name is, I thought, oh, well, what is her name? And I was reading I was in the bath, actually, and maybe more information than you wanted to know. But I was reading an essay by Joseph Campbell, and it talked about Hina, this goddess in this Polynesian myth. And I thought, Hina, that's the perfect name. It also ties in with some of the symbology of what I wanted her character to represent. And every name has is important. So I thought, Hina, that's her name. Yes. Any other questions? Yeah. Okay. Not as Banyan, actually, in my head, so, yeah. Electric City. Electric City, not Emerald. It's not, that's a Wizard of Oz, I think. Yeah. In my head... And I like to leave things somewhat open so that people can build the story for themselves. But in my head, it is the remains of Las Vegas. So it sits at the end of that, in the book, they're going along the 40, which is the remains of, like, Interstate 40. And it's sort of the last the last thing that remains that is high-tech. It's where Gentech, the people who grow or, manufacture the corn, that's the only source of food and fuel. It's where they're based, so it's the place with the money and the place with the technology. So it's this. I won't ruin the book, but you maybe get some glimpses of it as you get into the book, and you will maybe get some more glimpses of it in later books in the series. Okay, yes. Well, now people are warm. Okay, yes, Jen. Yeah, I like to write any time of day. Anywhere that it's really quiet, and once I get started, I can't stop. So I try to have done everything else I need to do that day before I start writing. I write on a computer. I type. I have really bad handwriting. I'm also a really bad typist, so I'm this weird Hunter Pecker person who can think of things way faster than I can type them. So probably doesn't look that cool when I'm writing it, but it feels awesome. It's the most fun that I know how to have by myself. Next question. Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay, good. This will be a segue. Maybe if there's two other questions, and then I'll talk about the tree, because that's a good segue into something else I wanted to the prizes and things that I'm going to give away. So, yeah, one question here. Not really. No, I didn't know about that being a thing. I just thought the main character would be 17, or in my head, young. I never actually knew how old he was. I just figured he was sort of about 17. And then the publisher, they're like, well, how old is he? And I'm like, I don't know. I kind of want people to, he could be 14 or he could be 24. I want people to make up their own mind. And they're like, yeah, that's cool. But how old is he? And I'm like, well, I guess he's like, 17. And then they're like, great. And so then it's funny because when you pick out the book, first thing it says is 17-year-old Banyan is a tree builder, which is kind of funny. But now, yeah, he's definitely 17. Even though he doesn't know how old he is because he never went to school or had birthdays or anything. I just wanted the book to be a sort of a coming of age story, and that seemed to me like a cool age for him to be someone who, you know, his father, who was his only friend, is now missing. So he's sort of, he's become this loner and a nomad. And when he, when the vision, the idea of him building these metal trees popped into my head, he was about 17, and so I just sort of rolled with it. But he's not, you know, because there isn't a high school, and he's not, in a way, his age is very important, because it, but in a way, it's really not important at all, because it's not about, a, you know, someone who goes to a school or does things that a 17-year-old in our world does. So that's why I said to them, you know, he could be 14 or 24. But, yeah, 17 sounds about right. And then my agent was like, oh, this is great, because it's young adult, which is this awesome place to be in the marketplace. And I was like, well, yeah, of course. No problem. Okay, one more question, and then I'll talk about this beautiful thing here. Well, you already asked one. Does anyone else have one? Yeah, this chap right here. Yeah. It is a series. There's three books in the series, or there will be. I've written the second one, and I've started work on the third one about a week or so ago. So I've always known how it would ultimately end, and it's going to be a really sad moment for me anyway when I write the last sentence, because to me, the characters are, I don't know if they're extensions of me or just people that I know really well now in my head, which maybe makes me sound a bit mad. But I do, I feel like they're like these close people that I spend all this time with, you know, hours upon hours upon hours, days upon days. And so when I say goodbye to them, it will be bittersweet. Okay. Oh, okay. One question, and then we'll talk about this. Yes. I think it's probably important to, unless you, because I think it's important to know where you're going. Maybe you don't know how you're going to get there, but I think that helps you know why you're writing the book, because you know, you sort of know the ending is like the ultimate thing that you're, the message, the culmination of all the themes and everything you've been working towards. That's the ending. So, okay. One more question. All right. Yeah. Yeah, the question was about the hero's journey, Joseph Campbell, Star Wars, all the wonderful myths and things. Yes, I did. I think if you think about it too much, it might be sort of a formula, you know, because you're like, oh, and then this happens, and then this happens. And Joseph Campbell was a extremely intelligent and awesome man, but he wasn't writing guides for writing. You know, he wasn't writing how to write a novel or a, you know, screenplay or whatever. So I think it's not a formula, but I think it's cool to, I guess, feel like you're tapping into what he talks about all the myths and stories are tapping into, which is the experience of being alive and not trying to find the meaning of life, but trying to find the real meaning of what it means to be alive. And so those, my story, you know, someone searching for something important that's been lost, in this case the trees, they don't just represent nature or the environment, they represent to me that elixir that Joseph Campbell talks about, which is that special, sacred, spiritual, whatever you want to call it, that elusive thing that we're all searching for, and in our own way, in our own lives, all the time. And so the book, you take, you know, the trees become a symbol of that in this story. But, you know, it's about searching for that thing that you think that if I can find it. And then, you know, it's about the journey, of course, not the destination. So, yeah, the ending, when you read it, I think the ultimate ending of the series definitely reinforces that. Great question. Thanks. I don't think we can top that question because it was so awesome. So I'm going to go back to this chap's question, and I'm going to talk about this, and I have some prizes to give away. But I'm going to talk about this first. So I'm going to tell you the name of the person. He goes by many names. We call him the captain, but he's right back there in a white shirt. He's waving right there. His name's Nick, if you don't know him, Nick Kapke. And is a wonderful man, a very dear friend of mine, and a very talented artist. And this ties in a few things that I'm going to talk about. One, I had no idea that he was making this, except he did come over one day and ask if I had any pieces of, like, old tree lying around. And we had an aspen that I had to cut down, which is an important, it's an important part of the book, aspen trees, Populus tremuloides. If you haven't read the book, you may run into some of them, at least in tattooed form. Anyway, I had cut this tree down, because it was dying, to let the aspen regenerate and the new ones grow up. And so we'd been using chunks for firewood, and he came over and picked this up and whisked it away. And then tonight he presented this, which is a beautiful creation. I'm blown away by it, in which it's obviously the metal work similar to what Banyan does, but then infused into a real tree. And it really captures a lot of what the book is about, because Banyan takes these scraps and turns them into something beautiful for people, and then he sets off to try to find real living trees. And that whole idea of infusing those two things together is encapsulated by this. This is not one of the prizes that I'm going to give away, because I am never going to give this away. This is I know exactly where I'm going to put it, in fact. So I'm going to back up a little bit and say that I told you that Hina, with the tattoo, was inspired by another very dear friend of mine, who's actually Nick's wife, then girlfriend at the time that I tell this story. But she has a beautiful tattoo very similar to the one that Hina has, the character in the book. And her tattoo was inspired by a drawing that Nick had done of an aspen tree. Beautiful drawing. And the tattoo then inspired me. It's in the first chapter of the book, so it's a big part of the book. And it kind of set me off a little bit on the journey of, you know, of the story itself. And so, you go from a drawing to a tattoo to a book, and then, you know, a talented artist at Scholastic makes the cover, and, you know, and then hopefully you pass on that inspiration, and people, you know, write their stories or write a poem or paint a picture or whatever and be inspired to do those things. And I asked Nick, would you draw another tree and we'll frame it up and offer it as a grand prize for the book launch. So I have one tonight, and it's right here. So look at this. It's an original one-off, a unique drawing. Now I'm worried about how I'm placing it. I'm just going to set it down like this. Same chap. Did this. And if you want to learn more about how he made it, because I have absolutely no idea, I made up the whole tree building stuff. I don't do any welding or anything. You'll have to ask him. He's also the Tripnotist, who you should hang out and experience afterwards, because that's rad too. So he's really a creative. I almost feel like he should be up here talking, perhaps, instead of me. But anyway, so that's the grand prize. I also have some other prizes that I'm going to give away right now, and then stick around for music, and I'll be signing books and all that other good stuff. So let me just take another quick sip of tea. Okay, the first one is, I'm going to put the microphone in the microphone stand. First one is a beautiful rootless t-shirt, which are available for purchase if you don't win this prize. And this great, awesome dude back there in purple, Eric, at the merch table, will be selling these. Now, I can't tell you how soft they are. They're just they're super soft. And let's face it, they look good too. So I've been going back and forth on how am I going to award these prizes, because I actually have... how am I going to do this? So I'm going to do it like this, and I'm just making this up as I go along. I'm going to ask a question, and if you can answer the question, you get the prize, okay? Now, this is a test of your knowledge. You don't have to have read the book to be able to answer this question. So, the question is, there are two characters in the book that are named after songs. Both songs are by the same band, a band from the late 1960s. And the characters' names are King Harvest is one, and Jawbone is the other one. Now, if you can name the band who wrote both of those songs, you will win the prize, and you got to raise your hand. Anybody? Okay. Anybody else? Oh, yes. No. No, although Bob Marley is infused in the book in his own special ways. Yes. No. Okay, I'm going to give you another clue. They began life before they were a band of their own. They were Bob Dylan's band. The Band, yes. Yeah. Okay, now, in this future, nothing grows except the genetically engineered corn owned by Gentech Corporation. And Banyan eats a lot of microwave popcorn. His favorite flavor is mac and cheese. I couldn't find a mac and cheese flavored popcorn that was healthy option, not GMO product. But this one's white cheddar. So it's, you know, it's nice. Similar to mac and cheese. And I'm giving this away as a prize to... Let's see. Are there any teenagers here who have read the book? Yes? And how old are you? 11. So you're like not even a teenager yet. Awesome. In which case, I wanted to give it to the youngest reader, and I'm pretty sure 11 is it. Speak now. That's awesome, by the way. What's your name? Emily? Well, it's nice to meet you. I'm Chris. Okay, grand prize is, and I actually know who I'm going to give this to, so. Because I've been scoping them out. I wanted to give it to the person who I thought had the coolest costume. There's some really good ones here. We have pirates, the Tripnotist. We also have a Rastafarian warrior, Ian. You got the. I love your costume the best. Please come up to receive the grand prize. Yeah. Yeah. There we go. Dad, turn around. He doesn't just. If you read the book, you would recognize he's a very particular character. Not just any Rastafarian warrior. He's got the staff and the bark mysteriously growing on his belly. So. Now, okay, so I'm really glad that Ian won because it's also his birthday today, and I think it would be really cool if we could sing him happy birthday really quick because it's a really we got a good group of people, right? Yeah. Okay, so it's Ian. So when you get to the happy birthday, dear, if you don't know him, Ian, got it? Okay. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Ian. Happy birthday to you. Thank you again so much for coming. It really means a lot to me.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.